I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is former Senator and U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace, George Mitchell. Joining him is fellow former U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace, Alon Sakar. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces George Mitchell and Alon Sakar.
So Senator George Mitchell is here with us this evening. A U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace from 2009 to 2011, he served as a Democratic Senator from Maine from 1980 to 1995 and Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. He was also the primary architect of the 1998 Good Friday Agreement for peace in Northern Ireland, which resulted in an agreement that ended an historic conflict. Named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine, Senator Mitchell is the author of 5 books, including The Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life, and A Path to Peace. Appearing in conversation with Senator Mitchell this evening is Alon Sakar, a former advisor to U.S. Ambassador to Israel Daniel Shapiro and to President Obama's Special Envoys for Middle East Peace. Alon is co-author with George Mitchell of A Path to Peace. Please join me in welcoming them to the JCCSF.
Thank you very much, Stephanie, for that generous introduction. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your warm reception. My thanks to Alon for joining me here, although I traveled all across the country. He lives here, so he didn't have very far to go. So I'm going to say a few words about our book. I'm going to ask Alon then to speak briefly on a specific subject, which I'll describe one aspect of our book, and then I'll conclude with some general remarks, and then we'll go to your questions and hopefully have a dialogue on any subject that's of interest to you. Alon and I met when President Obama appointed me as the U.S. envoy for Middle East peace. Shortly, he did it within 2 days after taking office. I had spent a good bit of time in the Middle East previously in my capacity as Senate Majority Leader, and then subsequently at the request of President Clinton, then Prime Minister Barack, and Chairman Arafat. In September of 2000, what became known as the Second Palestinian Intifada broke out. There was an enormous eruption in Jerusalem, beginning at the holiest of places for both Jews and Muslim Arabs. And I chaired an international commission, spent quite a bit of time traveling throughout the area. So when President Clinton asked me, President Obama asked me to go over, I assembled a staff, and I made a decision to rely primarily and almost exclusively on people already within the government, in the State Department, who had direct personal experience, knowledge, and what I felt was good judgment on the subject. And Alon was then a career person in the State Department. He had worked on Middle East issues, had spent time in the region, has since, after I left a few years later, spent time in Jerusalem and worked on the subject, and is probably one of the foremost experts on Israeli land law, which is an important issue in terms of dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So he's born and raised in San Diego and now lives here in San Francisco, so it's very convenient for him to come here, but he's done a terrific job, and I'll ask him to say a few words later. We wrote the book because we believe that the only realistic way to bring the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to an end is through the creation of two states. And we are concerned that support for the two-state solution is declining in Israel, among Palestinians, and also in the United States. It's understandable that an objective that has for so long been sought and not achieved has led some to conclude that it's not possible, and therefore alternatives ought to be pursued. In the book that we wrote, and in specifically in one chapter, chapter 9, which alone drafted, we analyzed in as detailed a fashion as possible the alternatives that have been suggested. They're largely, they fall into, I guess, two categories. One is the so-called one-state solution, in which there would be a single state embracing Israelis and Palestinians. And the alternative is what many on the Israeli side hope for, is some continuation of the status quo in some form or another that maintains Israeli control, and the Palestinians are in some other capacity other than being full citizens in a society and do not have a state of their own. We believe that a partition between the two groups is inevitable, and alone will discuss that now in some detail, and then I will return after he completes his remarks on that subject and will speak in a more general sense about the conflict specifically between Israelis and Palestinians and the upheaval in the entire region that is now occurring, which in fact impacts on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We believe it's important that the conflict not be viewed in isolation from the region in which it exists. It affects external events, and it in turn is influenced by external events. Of all the questions I've been asked since I returned from both Northern Ireland and the Middle East, the most common is, what are the similarities and the differences? Or sometimes put more bluntly, you're able to get a peace agreement in Northern Ireland, why couldn't you get one in the Middle East? One part of the answer, a small part but important, is that the two are, while they have surface similarities and serious similarities, differences in religion, differences in national identity, territorial disputes, nonetheless, there are many other factors that are exclusive to one or the other. And one of the principal ones is that the Northern Ireland conflict was largely contained within the islands of Ireland and the United Kingdom, or Great Britain. There weren't external factors. There wasn't upheaval on all borders. There were religious differences, still are deep religious differences between Catholics and Protestants, but there wasn't the complicated religious circumstance that exists in the Middle East, where you not only have religious differences between Jews and Muslims, but you have huge, festering, indeed violent conflicts within Islam itself. And those are significant in analyzing the situation and assessing how best to proceed. There are about 7.5 billion people in the world today. 1 in 5 is Muslim, just over 1.5 billion. According to projections by the United Nations, by the approximately the middle of this century, there'll be 10 billion people in the world. And at that time, 1 in 3 will be Muslim, about 3.5 billion. Put that in a perspective, that was the total population of the world as recently as 1970. And as we all know, there are deep divisions within Islam. The principal one being between Sunni and Shia goes back to the founding of Islam, to the death of the Prophet Muhammad, when two groups competed for control of the caliphate that he had built. It was not a difference in religion. They didn't fight over religious doctrines. They fought over political control. The group which prevailed after a lengthy conflict, which extended over decades, became the Sunni, and the group which was defeated became the Shia. And in the 1,400 years since, they have been engaged in conflict, often long periods of remission, followed by periods of violent eruption. And we're now, Islam is now experiencing a period of substantial eruption, as we see every day in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, to a significant degree in Pakistan, and many countries in North Africa and around the Middle East. Those divisions, and those, that's not the only division. There are deep divisions within Sunni Islam, and there are deep divisions within Shia Islam. And those are going to continue, and those have an impact on the issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in many respects, but one which stands out. There are difficult issues where there are sharp and deep differences of opinion between Israelis and Palestinians. And any agreement will require compromise on both sides. The Israelis, of course, will be able to, the government of Israel will be able to act on behalf of the people of Israel, and the Palestinians will be able to act in behalf of the Palestinian people. But the Palestinians will not have a free hand, never have had, when dealing with the issue of Jerusalem. Because Jerusalem is a holy site to both religions, and it is important, very important, to all Muslims. So while the Palestinians will be able on their own to reach an agreement on boundaries, on water, on the right of return, and other difficult issues, they are unable, they do not have the political or other capacity to conclude an agreement on what is the most emotional, the most fraught, and the most difficult issue of all. It will require the consent of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, and many other Muslim countries. It's one example of how this issue is different from Northern Ireland or other conflicts in that it implicates a wider range of people and therefore makes the resolution of the conflict more difficult and complex. I'm going to now ask Alone to say a few words on the specific subject of the two-state solution and the potential alternatives to it, and then I'll conclude with a few general remarks before we go to the question and answer period. Again, thank you all very much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Mitchell. Your introductions of me have gotten more and more generous over time. I've never been confused for Henry Kissinger. But on the topic of two-state solution or alternatives, as Senator Mitchell said, we believe that partition is inevitable, that the question is not if, but when, how, and on what terms. And secondly, we also believe that delay in reaching a resolution to the conflict bears enormous risk, not just for Israel, but for the Palestinians. To understand why we believe partition is inevitable, we just need to look at the two types of alternative solutions that Senator Mitchell's raised. There are plenty of variations, but they generally exist within two buckets. One is a single binational state in which Israelis and Palestinians live together under one government. Now, the reason that doesn't work is simple. It's numbers. Between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River today, there are roughly an equal number of Jews and Arabs, about 6.2 million each. And competition under one government between two ethnicities, two nationalities, that is just a recipe for chaos and disorder. You don't have to look far in the world to see multiple examples of that. And in fact, civil strife and conflict between the two parties was the reason the territory was partitioned in the first place in the 1940s. In fact, it was the policy of the U.S. government prior to the Declaration of Independence of Israel. Well, they didn't really have a policy. The president of the United States at the time, Truman, he actually favored a binational state. Ultimately, obviously, it became apparent that that wasn't going to work. And for all of those reasons, we don't think a single binational state would work in the long run. Now, an alternative to that, as Senator Mitchell said, is some kind of maintenance of the status quo. Right now, in the West Bank and in Israel, the way that are organizing themselves is that the West Bank is divided into Israeli-controlled areas and into Palestinian-controlled areas. Palestinian-controlled areas are enclaves within the Israeli-controlled areas. They are not contiguous for the most part, but the Palestinians control most of their population. Now, people who believe in continuing that indefinitely, they rely on two key assumptions. The first being that with better economic opportunities, which Israel can help provide Palestinians, that will help appease them and satisfy their needs. And we also know from history that that doesn't work. When Israel first occupied the West Bank in 1967, in the years that immediately followed that, the Palestinian economy in the West Bank and Gaza Strip flourished by every metric that you can think of. Infant mortality was down, access to clean water was up, refrigeration, life expectancy. Palestinian GDP was increasing faster than any of their Arab neighbors. Of course, that was until the First Intifada, which lasted for 5 years, was crippling to their economy. But that didn't, I mean, it mattered to average Palestinians, but the idea of independence was more important to them. And in the 1940s, and before that, when the British were in control of the territory, and there was this unrest between the Jewish populations and the Arab populations, the British sent a commission to find out what was going on, what was the cause of the unrest. And their conclusion, one of them, was that even though the immigration of Jews to the region, refugees fleeing from pogroms and anti-Semitism and the rise of fascism and Nazism in Europe, that the influx of these Jews was actually creating some economic benefits to the local Arabs. But that didn't appease them. In fact, it only heightened their awareness and realization of and desires for independence. And so economics alone are not going to solve the problem or prevent future conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. The second assumption that people who believe in status quo permanence believe in is that the security cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians that exists today can continue on forever. I told you that the West Bank was divided between Israeli-controlled areas and Palestinian-controlled areas, and there is a great deal of cooperation between the Palestinians and the Israelis on counterterrorism, on maintaining security. And the reason for that is that a grand bargain was struck, basically, by the Bush administration in 2003 with what many of you have probably heard of, the Roadmap for Peace. That followed the Second Intifada, a very violent period, suicide bombings, Israeli operations in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, all very deadly. And the Palestinian security forces and their police, often during the Intifada, were unable to do anything about it or even took part in it. And so what President Bush told the Palestinians, and which the Israelis signed up for, was that prove that you can govern yourself, prove that you can maintain law and order, and prove that you can be an aid in the region to combating some of the security threats. And once you do that, you'll get a state. And it's been close to 15 years since that's happened, and the Palestinian public today is starting to lose faith in that approach.
You're listening to former Senator George Mitchell, who's joined in conversation by Alon Sakar. Both are former U.S. Special Envoys for Middle East Peace and co-authors of the book A Path to Peace, A Brief History of Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations and a Way Forward in the Middle East, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
President Abbas has done a great job maintaining security in the West Bank. If you ask any Israeli security official, they praise the Palestinian Authority's efforts. But it's losing popularity quickly because the Palestinian population in the West Bank sees Abbas's security forces as serving the interests of Israel more than they are serving the interests of Palestinians. He is being seen as weak. If elections were held today, he would not win. And so the people who believe in maintaining the status quo indefinitely in some version have to believe that this can continue on forever, that if the Palestinian Authority, as we know it today, fails, something else will come up in its place. That's just not realistic. And this reality, this threat that faces the Israelis, if the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank collapses and the Israelis have to reassert themselves and fill the void, that's just going to lead to endless, prolonged conflict, fatigue. And the reality of that is why, if you ask almost every single retired IDF chief of staff, Mossad chief, which is the Israeli version of the CIA, Shin Bet chief, which is the Israeli version, their internal police and internal intelligence, every single one of them has come out in support of the two-state solution because they know how untenable the alternatives are. In fact, those alternatives are not promoted by security officials in Israel. Those alternatives are promoted by ideologues and politicians. And the other part of our argument, and there's a lot more detail in the book, and I suggest you pick it up. just shameless plug. The other issue is that delay is incredibly risky because the longer the Israelis and Palestinians wait to figure out a solution to the conflict, the more likely it is for some of these alternatives that I described before to play out and for them to fail. And when that happens, reaching an agreement is going to be infinitely times more difficult, and it's really difficult today. And on top of that, even as time goes on, for Israel, an agreement means that they're going to have to withdraw some of their settlements back into what remains Israel. When Prime Minister Olmert and President Abbas were negotiating between themselves in 2006 to the end of 2008, they considered borders to draw between a future Palestinian state and a future Israel. If that would have taken place at the time, Israel would have had to evacuate around 70,000 Israelis from what would become a Palestinian state. If the very same borders were drawn today, Israel would have to evacuate 100,000 people. And so this gets harder to solve as time goes on. The conditions get worse. And so what's the reason we wrote this book is to reinforce the need for getting to a two-state solution and getting to a two-state solution as soon as possible. Thank you.
alone referred to the negotiations that occurred between the Palestinians led by President Abbas and then Prime Minister Ehud Olmert in the last 2 years of the presidency of George W. Bush. It's come to be known as the Annapolis process because it was initially announced in the city of Annapolis, Maryland. It was a serious and sustained effort at negotiation for which President Bush and his then Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, deserve credit. Unfortunately, it did not succeed. It was brought to an abrupt and unexpected end when violence broke out in Gaza between Hamas and Israel in late December of 2008. In January of that year, 11 months earlier, President Bush traveled to Jerusalem, and he assembled the leadership of both Israel and the Palestinian territories. He gave a powerful talk setting forth American policy and objectives. And we quote briefly from it in our book. I encourage all of you, if you're really interested in the subject, to when you get home tonight, to pull up that speech on your computers. Because he told the assembled leaders of both sides that the policy of the United States was a two-state solution for the simple reason that it was the only way that not only could they reach agreement, but that either side could achieve what it wanted. To the Israelis, the president said, "You have a state." I'm paraphrasing now, but you'll see if, as you read it, this is the gist of his remarks. He said, "You have a state, a very successful state, but the people of Israel live in constant fear and anxiety, unfortunately so." To the Palestinians, he said, "You don't have a state, you want one, and we support your effort to achieve one." But he said to the Palestinians, "You're not going to get a state until the people of Israel have a reasonable and sustainable sense of security." And he said to the Israelis, "You're not going to get that reasonable and sustainable sense of security until the Palestinians get a state." That has been American policy for a long time. It continues to be our policy, and I believe it to be the right policy. Many Americans don't agree with that. Many Israelis don't agree with that. There may be many of you who do not agree with that, but I think that's the only way this is going to happen. In direct negotiations between the parties, with the strong support and encouragement of the United States. Why hasn't that happened? There have been several efforts. In the first Obama term, when Alon and I worked at it, in his second term, when Secretary Kerry himself undertook it, prior to that, in the George W. Bush administration, in the Clinton administration, and in the George H.W. Bush administration. Well, one reason I concluded during our tenure that it wasn't happening was the fact that the two societies are themselves internally divided on the subject. There are recent polls show about half of Israelis favor a two-state solution and about half do not. And so an Israeli prime minister who goes into negotiations with the Palestinians is keenly aware that he or she, as the case may be, will be subjected to very harsh criticism for any hint of a concession made in the negotiating process by those who are opposed to a two-state solution. And he or she will want to have some assurance that the process will succeed in order to justify going through the difficulty that will ensue to get there. A Palestinian leader has the same feeling. Palestinian society is about equally divided on the subject. Hamas favors the use of force to end what they regard as an illegal occupation. The political party Fatah, which is opposed to Hamas and which is the basis of the Palestinian Authority, led by President Abbas, have renounced violence, have insisted on peaceful negotiation as the only route to statehood, have agreed to accept all prior agreements and to recognize Israel. So that society is divided. I spent many hours with Prime Minister Netanyahu and many hours with President Abbas. And I believe that one of the major obstacles now, and now I'm speculating based upon my experience with them, is that Prime Minister Netanyahu, I think, does not believe that President Abbas has the personal or political strength to enter into an agreement and to see that it's implemented. And therefore, he thinks the process cannot succeed, and therefore is unwilling to enter into serious negotiations, despite his many public protestations about wanting to negotiate, because he doesn't think it'll succeed because of the other guy. Abbas, on the other hand, has the same feeling, but for a different reason. He doesn't believe that Netanyahu is serious about a two-state solution. He cites the fact that Netanyahu has, in his career, campaigned against a two-state solution, then said he was for it, then campaigned against it again, then said he was for it, and now says he's for it, but the time isn't right. And this shifting position back and forth has another factors, they both know each other very well, have been at this for a long time, have convinced Abbas that a negotiation cannot succeed because of Netanyahu's insincerity in his mind, and he's unwilling to take the risk necessary to get into negotiations of the type that he engaged in with Prime Minister Olmert. I think sooner or later, and I hope it's soon, Israeli and Palestinian leaders are going to recognize that the risk of not agreeing is greater than the risk of getting an agreement. When I discussed this in detail many times with Prime Minister Netanyahu, particularly toward the end of my tenure when the Middle East was starting to erupt, he argued that we can't afford to accept Palestinian state led by the Palestinian Authority on the West Bank, because look at all of these states that are failing, and if that state fails, then we'll have a Hamas takeover on our doorstep. And that's a legitimate concern, because I'm sure many of you have been to Israel. Those of you who do not recognize the close proximity, the West Bank, to the center of Israel. But my response to Prime Minister Netanyahu was that there's a greater risk of the Palestinian Authority collapsing and Hamas taking over the West Bank in the absence of an agreement than there would be after an agreement. And we've seen that now developing in the few years since we were there. Abbas's support within the Palestinian people, among the Palestinian people, continues to decline in the absence of any progress toward a two-state solution. And he is increasingly being viewed by his supporters as a partner of Israel in maintaining the occupation. As Alon said, the Palestinian Authority has developed a very substantial internal security capacity provided by the United States and Jordan, which does the actual training, and we have people involved in that as well. And they are very aggressive in pursuing Hamas within the West Bank and preventing attacks on Israel. And that's why, as Alon noted, the Israeli security officials strongly favor a two-state solution because they recognize that there has to be a political track towards statehood of the Palestinian people for any Palestinian government to be able to continue this kind of security cooperation. It's not a well-known fact, but many of the attacks on Israelis come from portions of the West Bank that are controlled by Israel, that the Palestinian security forces are prohibited from entering. And their actions in preventing attacks by Hamas operatives in the West Bank upon Israel are so aggressive that when we were there, I was constantly visited by human rights groups, international human rights groups, who complained bitterly about the fact that the Palestinian Authority operatives were not recognizing democratic rights in the aggressive and vigorous manner that they pursued and arrested Hamas operatives, and wanted us to be critical of the Palestinian Authority because they were too tough on Hamas. Well, it's kind of hard to balance all of this, but that's the reality, but that's declining now, and that cannot continue indefinitely. There are separate factors now. Hamas and the Palestinian Authority are engaged in a negotiation to try to achieve reconciliation. They have two separate and competing interests in doing so, and this is the fourth time they've been through this. Previously, they reached agreement in general terms, but the agreements broke down when they get into the specifics. It's possible, perhaps even likely, that will happen this time. But sooner or later, their internal issues are going to lead them to a reconciliation, which hopefully will engage Hamas enough so that they will adopt the positions of the Palestinian Authority with respect to relations with Israel. And at that time, I think there'll be an opportunity to move forward, providing Israel's leadership is prepared to do so as well. We don't know when it will occur. I do believe it will happen, and I hope it will be soon. It is a rational argument for those who disagree to say that they've been trying to do this for years and it hasn't worked, you know, we've got to try something else. I guess there's a popular phrase, it's the definition of insanity to keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. But it's also a popular feeling to say, try again, and don't give in to failure. And I can say to you, I'll conclude by saying that in Northern Ireland, as I said, I chaired three separate sets of negotiations, and as I've said many times of the main negotiation, we had 700 days of failure and one day of success. And almost every one of those 700 days, as I walked out of the compound, the heavily guarded compound in which negotiations were conducted, and was confronted by, there was a kind of a press gathering right outside the main gate. And almost every day I was asked, Senator Mitchell, when you failed, when are you going home? And of course the question was correct. If your objective is to get a peace agreement and you don't have one, you failed at least until that point. And while I was often disappointed and doubting, I never fell into total despair. And we kept trying and we kept trying, and I reached a conclusion, two conclusions. There's no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. Conflicts are created, conducted, and sustained by human beings for human purposes. They can be ended by human beings. And you can't take the first no, or the 10th no, or the 30th no as the final answer. You have to keep trying, you have to keep coming back, and at some point, this conflict is going to end. And our hope and prayer is that it happens before there's a much greater loss of life, destruction of property, and division of people. Thank you all very much for having us here. We'd be now glad to take your questions.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features former Senator George Mitchell, who's joined in conversation by Alon Sakar. Both are former U.S. Special Envoys for Middle East Peace and co-authors of the book A Path to Peace, A Brief History of Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations and a Way Forward in the Middle East. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
There are a lot of very good questions.
Okay, go ahead.
One issue that is on a lot of people's minds is nuclear arms in the Middle East, and obviously what we know is going on in Asia, and whether or not you think there are any similarities, and if you could comment on that.
During the presidential campaign of 2016, President Trump made many controversial statements, some of which he has since reversed. One which has gotten little publicity and which, to the best of my knowledge, has not been reversed was to me particularly dangerous. He said that it might be a good thing if South Korea and Japan and Saudi Arabia got nuclear weapons so that the United States would not have to defend them anymore. I found that to be deeply troubling, and still do. The United States led the world into the nuclear age, and we've led the world since then in the effort to restrain the spread of these weapons, which are without any precedent in human history. There are only 9 countries in the world that have nuclear weapons, although there are dozens of countries that have the capacity to produce nuclear weapons. The majority of them voluntarily refrain from doing so in reliance upon the United States and the nuclear non-proliferation regime which the United States led the effort to create. We're self-critical in our democracy, and that's a strength of democracy, but sometimes we tend to minimize our successes. And that's been, in my judgment, a real success. Were South Korea and Japan and Saudi Arabia or any combination acquire nuclear weapons, I believe it would lead to the prompt collapse of the nuclear non-proliferation regime and the instantaneous spread of the nuclear arms race in the Middle East and in Asia. So having gone 70 years and gone from 1 to 9, we could go from 9 to 29 in a matter of a decade or so. There are 2 risks associated with that, one of which has been fairly widely publicized, the second of which I believe has not been sufficiently publicized. The first is, of course, the risk of a nuclear exchange between nations. We now see that in the comments back and forth between the president and the leader of North Korea, which could lead to a miscalculation on one side or another that could trigger what all of us hope and pray is unthinkable. But nations are very restrained because of the principle that's come to be known of mutual assured destruction. The greatest restraint on Kim Jong-un is the knowledge that if he launched a nuclear weapon on the United States, the retaliation would be overwhelming and would destroy his country. But if large numbers of countries have nuclear weapons, there will be an exponential increase in the risk that terrorist groups, specifically some of the Islamic extreme terrorist groups that operate in the Middle East, like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda, like others, all of whom have proclaimed as a principal objective the acquisition of fissile materials, and they don't have the burden of restraint that nations have, because they do not have defined boundaries. They do not have defined populations. If they were to undertake the explosion of a nuclear weapon, where would we drop the retaliatory bomb? I think it's a risk that has not received sufficient attention or publicity, but which is a very real risk. We are about to have the military defeat of ISIS, just as we achieved largely, not entirely, the defeat of Al-Qaeda. But I know for certain, and I think most people believe, that some other group is going to follow because the conditions which led to these groups haven't been defeated. And those conditions will be difficult to achieve. They require what doesn't exist in much of that region: stable governments that are able to meet the basic needs of their people. The region has been plagued by poor governance and widespread corruption, which go together. The presence of tens, hundreds of millions of young men and women lacking hope, opportunity, any realistic path forward in life. And so I think the risk of the acquisition of fissile materials by such groups, the absence of restraint on them, the desperation that they feel, and often the stated desire for martyrdom, is one of the huge risks of the spread of nuclear weapons. And I deeply hope that the president will reverse the prior statements and undertake a major effort to encourage restraint and to support the nuclear nonproliferation regime as it affects North Korea, Iran, or any other country that may be thinking about it.
I'm going to shift gears a little bit. There are a lot of questions about what's happening today in the United States and their current environment. Most questions, actually, are about that. Immigration has become a controversial issue since the president sought a travel ban. Can you comment on that?
Before I entered the Senate, I had the privilege of serving as a federal district court judge in my home state of Maine. What I most enjoyed is when I presided over naturalization ceremonies. They're immigration ceremonies, a group of people who come from all over the world, gathered before me in a federal courtroom in my home state of Maine. They'd gone through all the required procedures, and I administered to them the oath of allegiance to the United States, and by the power vested in me under a constitutional law, I made them Americans. It was especially moving for me because my mother was an immigrant, and my father was the orphan son of immigrants. My parents had no education. My mother could not read or write. She spent 50 years working nights in textile mills. My father was a janitor at a local school. But because of their efforts, and mostly because of the openness of American society, I was able to get an education and to become the majority leader of the United States Senate. I really do believe in the American dream because I feel I've lived it. After every naturalization ceremony, I took the time to meet individually with each new citizen, individually or in family groups. And I asked them to tell me about their lives, where they were from, why they came, how they came, what were their hopes and dreams. They're all very inspiring, different countries of origin from all over the world, but similar themes. And I thought that the most important theme was best summarized by a young Asian man when I asked him why he came, said in very slow and halting English, "I came because here in America, everybody has a chance." Think about the fact that a young man who could barely speak English had been an American for 10 minutes. It sums up the meaning of our country in a single sentence. America is freedom and opportunity. And that freedom and opportunity has given rise to enormous contributions to our society from people from all over the world. First and most important, everybody in America came from somewhere else. Literally everybody. Human beings first, according to anthropologists and historians, appeared on Earth about 200,000 years ago. But it wasn't until about 15,000 years ago that the first human beings crossed what is now the Bering Strait and entered what we now call North America, and over the course of the next several thousand years spread across North, Central, and South America. I guess they reached Maine last. And then the Europeans came from the West about 500 years ago. And interestingly, and kind of a sad commentary on human nature, there was discrimination and demonization and stereotyping from the very beginning. The British, the French, the Dutch, the Spanish fought with each other and with the Native Americans for a couple of hundred years to gain control of North America. And there was stereotyping then. Everybody's heard the phrase Wall Street. I'm not sure everybody knows the origin. The Dutch settled, were the first Europeans to settle what is now Manhattan. And they clustered on the very southern tip of the island of Manhattan. But they were fearful of attacks by those they feared and despised. So at the northern edge of their small settlement, they built a wall that became known as Wall Street. But they built the wall not to keep out the Native Americans with whom they dealt and traded. It was the British who they despised and feared. And of course, their fears were justified as later the British overwhelmed them and gained control of what is now, it's no longer New Amsterdam, it's now New York City. That's been a recurring pattern throughout our history. What is going on now, the demonization and stereotyping, has a long history in our country. Right here in San Francisco, after the earthquake of 1905 and the fires, the city leaders having to deal with the issue of how to educate so many children with all the schools destroyed, enacted an ordinance, infamous in history, in which they prohibited any child of Japanese heritage, even those born in the United States, from entering the public school system, and required them to attend an Oriental school previously attended by South Koreans and Japanese. It caused an international uproar, and ultimately the ordinance was withdrawn. The first anti-immigration laws passed were earlier than that, 1882, the Chinese Exclusion Act, to keep out Chinese because of the influx that had come in to build the Transcontinental Railroad. My father's parents were born in Ireland, and all across the eastern United States, in my home state of Maine, there were cartoons in the newspapers that showed a human face on the body of an ape. It described the Irish as subhuman, and the cities had signs, "Irish need not apply." The Italians were all stigmatized because some of them were criminals, and so the assumption was every Italian's a member of the mafia. And of course, no group in American history other than African Americans, the only group brought here involuntarily in chains and kept uneducated and unfree for centuries. The only other group that sustained more prejudice than anyone else are American Jews. It was fairly recently in our history, in the lifetime of certainly my lifetime and people in this room, when Jews were subject to heavy discrimination. I live in a building in Manhattan that was built by a group of wealthy American Jews who were very successful businessmen. They couldn't get in. They wouldn't let them into the buildings on Park Avenue. That's fairly recent in our history. So there's nothing new about this. It's an old strain. It's been played over again. And one other comment, the Ku Klux Klan, best known for its violence against African Americans in the South, but in fact achieved its greatest political success in politics in the North in the 1920s on a campaign of virulent anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism. They even elected some people in Maine and Indiana and in a few other states. So we have to recognize it's nothing new. It's an old song, been played often. But we've always overcome it. And the early arrivals of every one of these groups got their hands on the bottom rung of the ladder of success in America, and they pulled themselves up. And their children, and like myself and grandchildren, stood on their shoulders and pulled them up even further till they reached the pinnacles of success. Now think about this fact, very relevant here in this area. Three of the most successful businesses in the world are Apple, Amazon, and Google. Apple was created by Steve Jobs, whose father was born in Syria. Amazon was created by Jeff Bezos, whose adoptive father was born in Cuba. And Sergey Brin was a co-founder of Google. He was born in Russia. When you drive home tonight, ask yourself this question. Would we be a better country if they had not been admitted? Ask yourself another question. What do you think the chances are that if he'd lived his life in Syria, Steve Jobs would have created Apple, or Jeff Bezos in Cuba, or Sergey Brin in Russia? Genius knows no language, no race, no ethnicity. It can be found wherever there are humans, but it tends to flourish, whether it's freedom, opportunity, education, innovation, where every person can go, can rise as high and as far as talent, genius, and willingness to work will take them. Seven Americans received Nobel Peace Prizes in 2016. Six of them were immigrants. We're a better country because people have come from everywhere to contribute their talents, and we are a better country than the anti-immigration words and policies being pursued in our country today. And just as we have in the past, we will overcome this and we will emerge a stronger, better, more diverse, freer country than ever before. Thank you. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were former Senator George Mitchell and Alon Sukkar. Both are former U.S. Special Envoys for Middle East Peace and co-authors of the book A Path to Peace, A Brief History of Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations and a Way Forward in the Middle East. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.